Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine here on Royalton Community Radio, WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont. Todd Tyson in the studio, Henry Swayze on the line, colleague up in Burlington. We'll bring him up in just a moment, starting out with a tree-related piece of music from a chamber folk group called Night Tree. And this piece is called Fourist, F-O-W-R-I-S-T. And that's in advance of a discussion that we're going to have with a local person. At least he grew up in Sharon, Vermont. His name is Chris Gish. Looking forward to talking about the forests in Vermont. Green Zine is brought to you today. If I turn this sheet over, I'll be able to tell you. It's brought to you by the Yes We Can Collective, an in-house effort to redeem cans and bottles and add a little income to the bottom line of this radio station. Also, Solar Fest coming up on the 8th, 9th, and 10th of August in Brandon, Vermont. Numerous workshops, keynote speaker, and a whole lot of music over there. Solarfest.org for all the details. Wit and Grit, a breakfast and lunch establishment in Randolph, Vermont. The First Branch Coffee Company, located here on the Green in South Royalton, and also helping out with the next and every Royalton Farmers Market held on alternative Sundays. The next one coming up on Sunday, July 13th. The Upper Pass Beer Company, longtime supporter of the radio station and also supporting our 12th annual Pedal Power to the People event, which is combining with Fledge Fest. That date for your calendars is Saturday, August 23rd at the Fledgling Farmstead in Tunbridge, Vermont. Solaflect and Bale round out the number of our underwriters here. We'll play a little bit more music here from Night Tree, and then we'll bring Henry up in the mix. We have a pretty packed show for you here on Green Zine. As the Bowron slips in there, I'm going to put pause. We might hear the rest of that piece at the end of the show, but I want to say good morning to my Green Zine colleague, Henry Swayze. How are you, Henry?
I am good, and nice to hear some music.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A break in the tension of the times.
Well, you know, if we might have an open house here later in the summer at the studio, and a lot of it is going to be showing people our music collection. We have a lot of CDs through donations, including a recent major donation from Carl Newman, who's in the midst of moving from his apartment in Morgan Orchards to a apartment right behind the Playhouse Theater in downtown Randolph. And he's going to be unloading a few things. And I estimated that he just donated 12 lineal feet of CDs to the studio, which probably adds up roughly to about 400 different recordings.
I was just going to say that's probably about 400. I got about 300. and I just recently moved them all. By the foot.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some crossover in the libraries between you and Carl. Yeah, great music, of course. But this is not a music show, but we do sprinkle some music in, and good to have you with us, Henry. Why don't you start off by telling us who we're going to be talking to in about 15 minutes or so?
Well, so as you mentioned, it's Chris Gish, and he is a representative now, is actually on the payroll for Standing Trees Vermont. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking not only about the forests in Vermont, but the forests in national forests in New Hampshire because of clear cutting there as well. And just the problem that the way the Forest Service is managing forests is not managing it for the climate. It's managing it for wood production, and they clash with one another, and we'll get into those details. And we're starting off with a bird note. basically asking the question, why do you see birds being fledged out of the nest and then getting continue to get fed out in the shrubbery and in places that seem more
dangerous.
Dangerous, yes.
Yeah.
Hazardous duty.
Right. It could be a short bird life. Well, let's check this out. It's called Toddlers, Fledgling Chickadees. We've been hearing a lot of fledgling robins that are ready to burst out of the nest. We'll come back and speak briefly about that. And then I do have a little bit of a piece I want to do that's taken from Democracy Now! Episode just a couple days ago. Here we go. Let's go to Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Sometimes in the spring or summer, you might come across a young songbird that's just left the nest. It's a fledgling, fully feathered, but with wings and tail still looking a bit stubby. Fluttering furiously on those short wings, it flies a short distance to the safety of a nearby bush. Like a toddler, it's unsteady, awkward, and learning the ropes. It may look like this young bird has left the nest too soon. In the case of the black-capped chickadee, just 16 days after hatching. But there's an adaptive advantage for nestlings to exit the nest as soon as they are able, even if they're not quite ready to fend for themselves. A nest full of begging young can be a target for a predator. Rather than risk the whole brood to a raccoon or snake, adults may feed the young, one stashed here, one there, in greater safety as they toddle from shrub to shrub. By about the 10th day after the young leave the nest, though, chickadee adults stop feeding them and may even turn aggressive, meaning it's time for the youngsters to disperse and feed themselves. At this point, they're fully fledged, should have their full set of flight feathers, and be ready to take to the skies. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note is provided by Mary Piggott from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
Well, that was very interesting, Henry. I like that.
Yeah. So there's a quite lovely video that I've put in the Bird Notes. It's all of 40 minutes, but it is... you don't have to watch the whole thing, just watch some of it, but it is quite delightful. It's a Canadian person who has built bird boxes with cameras in them in order to track chickadees laying eggs, building nests, and hatching and fledging their young. And it's very personable. The birds are named, and the male had a different female the year before, and she's got it all down. So that's in our Bird Notes. Blue link at the bottom of the main page of Royalton Community Radio.
Yes, indeed, a wealth of information there. Let's go. Well, we're only 9 minutes into the show, but I wanted to do this snippet, and if we have time at the end, we might explore some recent comments about heat domes and climate heat waves in Europe, etc., from Michael Mann, someone that we've heard of on the previous show in the past with Alex Smith. But I'm going to go to this little excerpt that was aired on, you know, we talk often on this show about climate issues maybe not being addressed by mainstream media as much as they should. But Democracy Now! The other day spent basically the last 15 minutes of the show on Tuesday. So if you wanted to get the full piece, you could probably find it somewhere online. So we're going to go to this, and I think this includes some comments from a special rapporteur from the UN. And then, Henry, we'll be back with you. Let's let her roll.
Scientists say the burning of fossil fuels by humans is the primary cause of global warming. This week, the Senate's debating measures to include in Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Budget bill. Is set to shape in U.S. fossil fuel policy in ways expected to accelerate fossil fuel extraction, in part by cutting hundreds of billions of dollars of clean energy incentives. In fact, taxing more clean energy incentives. This comes as the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights in the Context of Climate Change presented a new report Monday on the imperative of defossilizing our economies. This is Elisa Morguera addressing the UN Human Rights Council.
So what does defossilization mean? It entails prioritizing the phase-out of fossil fuels, including various forms of financing them, within and beyond the energy sector. It means recognizing and prioritizing the phase-out of fossil fuels as the single most impactful health contribution. Defossilization underscores the need to focus on fossil fuels, also in connection with the growing production of plastics and petrochemicals, which cause an additional layer of human rights harms and further diminish nature's contribution to climate regulation and human resilience. Defossilizing our economies then means tackling all the financial benefits the fossil fuel companies are still gaining.
Morguera also called for a ban on fossil fuel industry lobbying and advertising and urged criminal penalties for those who spread disinformation about the climate crisis. For more, we're joined by Michael Mann, the president.
Okay, I'm going to bring that down in case we get back to that. Thought that was pretty interesting, Henry, the rapporteur's comments. And I think it kind of flows nicely into something you were talking about, some phone banking that's going on by a lot of citizens who are calling representatives in districts as that big, whatever you want to call it, the big horrible bill, the big beautiful bill, is now going back to the House. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. So I participated yesterday in some phone banking, and we've recommended on the show, at least I have, I think Todd would second that you call friends you might have in more Republican states and get them to weigh in with the legislators about things that are wrong with a big bad bill.
Yeah.
So the League of Conservation Voters apparently is across the country, and the Vermont League held a phone bank, which I went to last night or last evening, and it was a very interesting experience. And so the way it works is that you can call people, and the Democrats have thought about who is vulnerable, who might change their vote if they were getting pushback from their voters. And they listed four Republicans, and the one we focused on was Robert Bresnahan from Pennsylvania. And so they set it up so that we could call a list of people that they had already identified as thinking positively about climate issues and wanting to work on them. And they made it so that our call to those people came from a Pennsylvania phone number. So we looked to those people as though we were local people. And we said, I said, I'm Henry Swayze, and I'm supporting the Pennsylvania League of Conservation Voters, trying to support them. And what do you think about the big bad bill? and if I get, I love it, I'm, all for it, I'd say, well, thank you very much, and I'm on to the next one. And it's a sorting process to look for people who will call his office. And the beauty of it is it's all organized so that if the person says, yes, I would call their office, and you say to them, I could, with a push of a button, I could make it so you are calling their office and you can leave a message. They're probably have nothing but an answering machine going right now.
Right.
And you can just tell them. So it's all about a vote count thing. And And so we did that for about an hour and 20 minutes, maybe 20 other minutes to get organized on it. But it was a fun experience. And there were a dozen of people there and more people working from their home phones who'd done it before. But it was a learning curve to do it. It was nice to be with people who care.
Do you know, I forget what his name was, Bresnahan or whatever, where in Pennsylvania he's a representative?
He's representative for the House.
The House.
In the U.S. House. So all they have to do is they need three votes in the House, and they can kill this bill. And it's being hashed on right now. And in the Senate, they got it through because the administration carved out special privileges for Alaska and got that Alaska vote to go to a yes instead of a no.
Yeah.
And so it's political gamesmanship, but it's really all about, these politicians knowing that if they vote against this bill, they will get a lot of pushback from in the primaries where only the avid right and left tend to go and vote, not the general public. Mm. And so they get slammed in that and a lot of times knocked out of the water so that they aren't even on the ballot for next go around. And some choose to change parties in order to or become independents in order to continue to try and continue their political career. But it's a tough road to hoe to change parties and have your supporters cross over and follow you. It's not the way politics ought to run.
No, and
maybe the way politics run, but it's not the way election systems. I think they need instant runoff with multiple parties.
Yeah. We have become less grassroots of a less grassroots democracy over the last, well, really for 40 years, but certainly since Citizens United. So I'm going to use this term, political harakiri. If you are a Republican House member who's thinking about voting against the bill and knowing that it could be political suicide, all 435 House members are up for election in 2026. So that's coming right up. And you could go down if you're going to go down in two ways. You could, one would maybe be a little bit delayed. The one way is to buck Trump and say, you know what, I've questioned my constituents, very much like the senator who is not going to run again, Tom Tillis from North Carolina. And this would be devastating to my state if this bill goes through as far as Medicaid, other federal services that are going to be cut. Therefore, I am voting against it, which he did. But the chickens will come home to roost if you vote for this bill and some of the most negative things happen, then you'll probably get voted out maybe not the next term, because it'll take a little while for the negative things to kick in. Or you could, stay there and vote for it, and, you're probably still going to go. But I don't know. It's a good idea to see if some of those can be swayed. I was just wondering in Pennsylvania where it was, because sort of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, mostly liberal areas, central Pennsylvania, very conservative. I know there were a couple of representatives in Arizona that might be flipped. They wouldn't be in the Tucson area. That's a very progressive area, but maybe up in Arizona. But I'm glad that you spent some time doing that, Henry. Good for you. And we'll have to see. Now, that's all supposed to get wrapped up by tomorrow, according to the chief executive, correct? July 4th.
Of course, yes, July 4th. He just wants it his way, and it's the Republican scheme for getting things through, and they've been very successful at it. Don't let anyone look at what they're voting for until it's too late to digest it, and require them to vote now.
Right.
It's just you're buying a pig in a poke, and you suspect the pig is a rotten pig, but you don't know.
I like you brought that phrase back from way back. Hey, I'm going to let you go, Henry, and line up Chris Gish. It's 20 minutes after the hour. You are listening to Green Zine here with Henry and Todd. I'm going to give you a little bit more information. I've seen this notice quite a few times, and there's a deadline coming up of the next class is going to be July 21st, particularly if you are someone, and this is geared towards women who are 16 and over. Trailblazers program is happening down, I believe it's in White River Junction, and it is free training in construction and renewable energy trades. Now, those trades, when you can get a job there, whatever your age, pay pretty well. Program is safe, non-judgmental environment for you to build skills, gain confidence, and explore fields that have been historically male-dominated. We'll maybe try to get this website posted at our website, our Green Zine link. It is VermontWorksForWomen.org. And I think if you put Trailblazers in the search. But once again, VTWorksForWomen.org. The next class begins on July 21st in White River Junction and is open to residents from all surrounding towns. That would include our town. 7 weeks of free hands-on training held evenings and Saturdays covering core construction, trades, and renewable energy skills. You will get, if you complete the course, it is nationally recognized OSHA 10 certification. No cost to participate. The Hartford Trailblazers class will run from July 21st through September 4th at the Hartford Area Career and Technical Education Center. So once again, if you are a young woman or a woman over the age of 16 and you want to get into construction in the renewable energy industry, learn how to put up solar panels, maybe learn a little bit about geothermal, VermontWorksForWomen.org and use the search word, what was it there? I lost Trailblazers. And I think that's going to do it for that. I've got a lot more information here, but we're going to return and see if Henry's been able to get a hold of Chris Gish. Are you there, Henry?
Yes, I have. I welcome Chris Gish to Green Zine. It's great to have you on the air with us. Thanks for joining, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Todd and Henry.
All right, yeah. Chris. Yeah, I think the last time I saw you was over at a Standing Trees action over there at the Telephone Gap Forest Station a few months back. Man, I guess it was last fall or last summer.
It might have been in the winter, in January.
Oh, I guess it was. Yeah, I guess it was in the winter. Yeah, you spoke very eloquently. Now we get you to do that here on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Honored to be here.
So let's start off with why are we caring about forests to start with? What's the deal with forests? Are they important to the environment and how?
Absolutely, yeah. Could I take a half a step back and just introduce myself really briefly?
Please do.
I'm Chris Gish. I live in Richmond now. I grew up in Sharon, so just down the road from where you are. Worked my first farm job in South Royalton, and now I am a community organizer for Standing Trees, and we are focused on restoring and protecting natural forests, old forests, on our public lands in New England.
It's a great mission. Right. Great mission to have.
Okay, and so currently the national forests seem to be managed mostly about timber production, not about the environment. And am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even need to pass a judgment on whether it's mostly, but that is a large part of the picture. And our feeling, public lands are such a small fraction of our overall landscape in a place like New England. In Vermont, only about 6% of our state is state lands, and another 6% is federal lands, almost all in the Green Mountain National Forest. And our feeling is that these are by far our best opportunities to recover old natural forests, natural landscapes on a larger scale, and to let natural processes prevail and to manage them, frankly, in the highest possible public interest. So that's why we're focused on that, and we don't think that they have necessarily been managed that way in the past.
Okay, so how do forests help us?
Yeah, forests are so critical for all of the things you think of that nature provides us, these so-called ecosystem services. Forests are the thing that take carbon dioxide out of the air, give us oxygen to breathe, and accumulate that carbon above ground and below ground in their ecosystems. And forests are also our greatest buffer against extreme weather, against flooding. They give us clean, cool water when it hasn't rained in a while. They provide refuge for all of our native species, and if left to develop on their own, create all the habitat niches that our native species need to thrive. So all the things, they are overwhelmingly our natural land cover in this part of the world, and we haven't let our forests get back to that natural state yet.
And it was that New England was covered with a forest which the indigenous people actually did manage, but was much more of a diverse ecosystem than it tends to be now. Can you talk about a little bit of that, about that change and how that is important to making forests really kind of do the best work they can do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's essential context. And from what I understand, our indigenous people had a really deep relationship with our forests and all our natural landscapes in the area. But all the evidence points to them having a much lighter presence on the land compared to the presence that we see after Euro-American colonization and settlement. And there were some localized cutting, localized burning, but for the most part, researchers describe the vast majority of, especially interior New England, being in this old forest state. And then we see with Euro-American settlers arriving, multiple waves of land clearing, either burning it for potash, harvesting trees for lumber, clearing for grazing and tillage agriculture, all those things. So at one point, Vermont was 80% cleared, 20% forested. Now we're back to about 76% forested, but our forests are remaining in this degraded state to some extent.
Yeah, well, there was really good topsoil that was generated by those original forests, and that's why people cleared the land and farmed on them, but mm-hmm. they didn't farm in a very, a regenerative way, so the soils were actually lost in the process, a lot like what's happened in the Great Plains with tilled agriculture and smart Homo sapien working on that. So can you say what happens when you let one of these kind of second growth forests get older? As it gets older, what do you see changing, and how much better does the forest, say, help with climate change as it gets older?
Yeah, our forests are, we're so blessed in New England to have our forests and have a climate that let them bounce back from our landscape being, frankly, abused in the past. And what happens when we let our forests grow back is that they begin to accumulate much more carbon, pull it back out of the air, which just to like keep us in the proper context, we kind of celebrate our forests for pulling carbon out of the air, but we need to remember that they're pulling carbon that has been a multi-generational debt. Like all of that was put into the air over the last few centuries and has been causing climate change as our land has not had the natural forest that it once had. And our forests are doing valiant work to get some of that back. And researchers estimate right now, the study from 2023 estimated that by 2100, so in well less than a century, our forests in New England could double the amount of carbon they store that they've accumulated if we were to let them grow old. And again, for context, only less than a third of a percent, about a third of a single percent of our forests in New England are over 150 years old. And researchers estimate that it takes at least 350 to 400 years for forests to even approach the maximum amount of carbon they can store. So our forests have so much potential to do this essential work of pulling carbon out of the air, even as we're focused on reducing fossil fuel use and reducing, putting greenhouse gases in the air, which is absolutely essential. We also need to be pulling them down. And this is one of the most proven cost-effective ways to do that. And that comes with so many other wonderful benefits.
Yeah, I want to stick with the cost effectiveness, or at least the cost factor, which I think is driving the struggle to save and promote old growth forests. And thinking of the Forest Service plan for over there at Telephone Gap, and I certainly want your perspective on that, is that they're unlike when there was indigenous management and before European settlers came here, indigenous people were not operating on a capitalist system of resource extraction for monetary gain. That certainly is the case today in forestry. It's you know, environmental management, but also there's loggers, there's jobs involved, etc. And we know that the forest management plan does give a fair amount of deference to that side of the equation, without looking ahead 150, 200, 300 years. So how do you start to make that shift in perspective in the public and in the politic of people looking at preserving old growth as having actually more value to the future than the current plan? And then a final just comment from you on how much did the original Telephone Gap Forest Service plan change from the early days till when it's, I think it's getting pretty close to being implemented, how much change based on public comment was made in the plan?
Yeah, great question. I'll circle back to Telephone Gap in a second. And okay. I think the economic drivers are a key thing to have our eye on. And I think a place to start to change that is our public lands, because in theory, at least, if not always in practice, they should be managed for the public interest. And they're not state-owned lands. They're state-managed lands, and they're owned by all of us. So they're not federal. They're not owned by the government. They're owned by all of us, and the government should be representing our interests. And I think that is a great window into speaking up and speaking for a different paradigm, as literally thousands of people did in a project like Telephone Gap. And it's also important to keep in mind that across the country, and particularly in New England, our public lands play a really small role in the so-called forest economy. In Vermont, only 2% of our timber products come from state lands, 2% come from federal lands. And that is in a context where we're producing a lot more timber products than we even use in Vermont. And some of those, and that's even with these arguably really wasteful uses of timber products, like burning them for kilowatts for electricity in our biomass plants. So we have a lot of room to preserve valuable parts of the wood products economy without having to go after these exceptional tracts of old and maturing forests in areas that are some of our best opportunities to let natural forests recover. And I just see public lands as the opportunity to have, as one of the best opportunities to have a more honest conversation about that, and how we can have the wisdom to step back from quote unquote managing or actively managing every square inch of our landscape. And then with Telephone Gap, so brief update is this is a massive logging project that has been in the works for years in the Green Mountain National Forest, kind of between Pittsfield and Rutland, so west of Pittsfield, north of Route 4, south of Route 73, along the spine of the Green Mountains. It's named after a landscape feature along the spine, the Telephone Gap, so-called. And the Forest Service a couple weeks ago issued their final decision on it, and the project has not substantively changed from its original. Originally, it was proposed to be a 12,000-acre logging project. Now it is a 10,959-acre logging project, so just under 11,000. And it's important to note that changes were made, which is it's different and it's an improvement from past projects. There were over 2,300 unique comments filed for the project, so an unprecedented public engagement for any project on the Green Mountain National Forest. The comments were overwhelmingly concerned with or opposed to the scale of logging proposed. We also got the first ever carbon assessment for any logging project anywhere in the country on public lands that I'm aware of, wow. or at least on federal lands. And that showed that the project would emit over 250,000 tons of CO2. So just logging this one area, there's four other projects currently underway in other parts of the national forest that are about the same scale. So just this one project alone would emit the equivalent amount of over 60,000 average passenger vehicles driven for a year. So that's a good chunk of carbon. And the only reason we even know the scale of that is because of the public intervention and the scrutiny that people brought, and especially around the connections between our forest and climate, and asked for that. And we got that. And there were some other modest changes that were made, I think, in an effort to kind of appease the outcry and the concern about this project, but they weren't substantive enough to really change the bones of it. And now I think we have a project that has a veneer of paying attention to older forests and late successional characteristics, but really it's still just a massive commercial logging project, and it still targets all of the eastern region old growth that is identified in that area. So out of only 2,000 acres identified across the whole national forest, and this is from under the Biden administration when national forests around the country were told they had to inventory all their old forests, the Forest Service in the Greens found there was about 2,000 acres that met this regional definition, and now they want to cut in 817 of those acres, which are all of the acres within the Telephone Gap area. Mm. So just that alone kind of speaks to the level of care or not that went into this final plan, and it seems like the Forest Service had a vision of what they wanted to do from the start, and they were pretty dug into making it happen despite whatever the public might have wanted.
So you filed some lawsuits to try and head this off. Am I right about that? Can you tell us about that?
We have not filed any lawsuits about Telephone Gap or any other logging project in the Green Mountain National Forest. We've been working with Earthrise Law Center, which is the law clinic of Lewis and Clark College, to develop our comments around Telephone Gap. There are three comment periods, so that lays the groundwork for any legal challenges that we might have for this project, and we're still exploring our options for that. But we have litigated now two suits have been filed against similar logging projects in the White Mountain National Forest just across the river in New Hampshire. And those suits are still pending, but that is... It's sad that we have to do that, but it is kind of turning over a new leaf for public lands management in this part of the country, because there hasn't been a lot of public accountability in the legal space for these public lands management actions in the past, in this century. So we're making that happen. And if it comes down to legal action, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, it does seem as though the Forest Service just has their heels dug in on business as usual, and then the Trump administration is coming along and saying, let's make it so that you can cut roads into the areas that have been illegal to build roads in across the country. And we know mm-hmm. what that's done in the Amazon when they've gone in the previous administration in Brazil, encouraged logging in the Amazon jungle. And when those roads went in, then there was lots and lots of extraction going on, and it's doing a pretty good job of shutting down the rain cycle in the Amazon basin, which is even more biologically active than New England.
Mm-hmm.
So can you comment on that Rhodes bill and the pushback there?
I can, definitely comment on that. That's all essential context. And our forests, similarly here in the U.S. and in so-called Turtle Island, are equally essential for stabilizing our climate, cooling our air just by transpiring moisture up through their bodies every day and shading the soil. And across the U.S., national forests are the single largest source of drinking water. They're the source of drinking water for, conservatively, it said 60 million people. So even a lot of towns in Vermont get their drinking water from our national forests. But then if you zoom out across the country, a lot of large cities like L.A. and Salt Lake City also get their drinking water from national forests. So as far as roadless areas, since 2001, the U.S. has had a roadless area conservation rule on the books, and this was the result of the largest groundswell of public comments ever for a public land management decision, kind of before the internet was even widespread at the end of the Clinton administration. Over 1.6 million official comments were filed, which is pretty impressive. And what that did was created a provisional protection for almost 60 million acres of our national forest land. So this is like the wildest fraction of our public lands that aren't already federally protected wilderness. And it said it's a pretty flexible rule that still allows for a lot of development, for better or for worse. But it said unless there's some emergency, there won't be logging or road building in these areas, and we'll try to preserve the wild roadless character of them. And just earlier earlier in June, the Trump administration, Trump's USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins, signaled that she was planning to repeal the roadless area conservation rule and open up these areas to road building and logging, which would be truly a disaster, totally unnecessary from a logging perspective. And we have plenty of timber supply already in this country, and the majority of it comes from private lands. And would be an unmitigated disaster for all the other services that these places provide. And even in New England, it would open up over 260,000 acres of our public lands, of like some of the most wild places you can think of, like the ridges in the White Mountains, the area around White Rocks National Recreation Area in Vermont. We could open up those areas to logging.
Hmm. Yeah. The Trump administration seems bent on destroying the environment. It's just not. It's senseless. A lot of it. It's just. We're against this stuff because it's environmental.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's mind-boggling to me. I can see them wanting to have an economy that worked well and be short-sighted about the long-term implications of that, but. Some of these rulings are just seem to be vindictive against anyone that cares about the environment.
Yeah, it does boggle the mind. And part of me interprets it as kind of like a last gasp of extractive capitalism and wanting to get what we can in any way we can while we can do it. But it's important to kind of see the whole federal context, and in addition to trying to repeal the roadless area conservation rule, there's also, I think you all were just talking about the reconciliation bill, the budget bill that's now going back to the House, and God willing, might be stopped. But that has, like, among all its other extremely problematic, disastrous provisions, it also has a lot of things related to timber production and other extraction on our public lands. It has a mandated increase in the amount of board feet, amount of timber volume that will be pulled off of public lands. And it's 250 million board feet more every year. So increasing by that amount every year for a decade, it lets someone who's going through the NEPA process. So that's the National Environmental Policy Act that lets us have these comment periods, like we had a telephone gap, and theoretically have a say in how our public lands are managed. it lets entities pay for an expedited NEPA process that's somehow immune to judicial review. So it's immune to being brought up in a court of law, which, as we were just discussing earlier, has been some of our last recourse and maybe some of the strongest recourse we have to stop these inadequately considered or ill-advised projects. It has other loopholes for also logging in roadless areas. It mandates, it opens up 200 million more acres to fossil fuel extraction on public land, all these things. So there's that bill. There's also the Fix Our Forest Act, which under the guise of wildfire mitigation, which we know that logging wild forest does not help with wildfire mitigation. I lived out in Montana at one point, lived in Colorado, saw all of that firsthand, and there is reams and reams of scientific literature to say that. But under that guise, this bill would do a lot of the same things, so gut endangered species protection, make it much harder to litigate or hold public lands agencies accountable in court. It would absurdly allow environmental analysis to happen after a project. So after a place is logged, then you could go in and analyze if it had any environmental impacts, which
that's a little backwards
to do anything about it. And that's all in the context of our public agencies being desperately understaffed and underfunded. So it just gives them even more incentive to kind of sell off or liquidate the best assets to pay for this whatever quote unquote work they would like to do.
Yeah.
In that moment.
Let's wrap this up on a positive note, hopefully. And that is, you know, with these dire consequences, if this big, bad, beautiful bill were to pass and the continued extraction and the Forest Service plans don't really start to take into account the environmental impacts of keeping old growth going. What can your local citizen, you're from Sharon, I know your parents, Chris, glad to have you on the air. Lots of people here are environmentalists. So in our immediate area, or even if going to the federal area, what can people do as far as contacting the Forest Service or your local representative for state forest lands, etc.? What would you advise?
Yeah, some immediate and really helpful interventions in the short term. The first one I would say is to contact Representative Ballant, who is in Vermont. She's our federal representative, to ask her to co-sponsor the Roadless Area Conservation Act. So this is a bill that would codify into law the roadless area rule protections that the Trump administration is now trying to repeal. So if this bill were passed, it would make a more durable version of the thing that Trump and his allies are trying to repeal. And Peter Welch and Bernie Sanders, our senators, are two of the co-sponsors on this bill. So it shouldn't be a big ask for Representative Ballant to also join on as a co-sponsor and lend her weight to it. So that's one really specific ask. Another thing that is wonderful, more of like a slow burn for this, but is to reach out to your local legislators about your state level legislators, senators and reps about the Vermont Wildlands Act, which is there's a whole website about it. You can go to vermontwildlandsact.org. But this is a bill that would protect about two-thirds of our state-managed lands as wildlands, so allow them to develop naturally into these old carbon-rich, abundant forests that we need so desperately. And that bill was introduced this first year of the biennium, this past spring, got some really positive testimony, and we'll be back next year. And in the meantime, we're trying to spread the word on that, so it would be great to lend your support to that bill. It can be as simple as a two-sentence email to your legislator and say, hey, I am really excited about the Vermont Wildlands Act. What do you think about it? It can be that anywhere to sitting down with them and having more of a conversation. And those are two things in the short term. And I'd also say the final thing, mark your calendar for September 27th, somewhere in Vermont, potentially Montpelier, potentially somewhere else. There will be a public lands teach-in and rally, so Public Lands Day of Action on National Public Lands Day on September 27th.
Well, that's great information, and we should remind listeners who probably already know, if you live in Royalton, the town of Royalton or the town of Tunbridge, our state representative, who probably knows all about this Vermont Wildlands Act, John O'Brien, Representative O'Brien, does serve on the Forest and Ag Committee. So his certain support, or I don't know if he supports it or not, but if he were to support that, I know the second year of biennium when something is introduced is when the, you know, the rubber hits the road, whether something like that gets through. So I would recommend people contacting Representative O'Brien.
Exactly. Yeah, that would be a great person to connect to. And I'm sure he'd love to hear from you.
Okay, Chris. Well, thank you very much for getting us caught up on so many different things, and glad to see that you actually have a paying gig with Standing Trees. Keep up the good work. I'll throw it back to Henry, and then we're going to wrap up the show with a few other items.
Okay, I just want to say that I will put a link to that Vermont Wildlands Act if you want to look in more detail in the show notes. So that is there, and the last Standing Trees newsletter that went out is also listed in those notes. So thank you very much for doing this work and joining us on Green Scene to spread the word. That's both horrifying things, but the nature of forest is kind of good for our soul and quite separate of the economy and the environment and so forth. It just allows us to be human beings.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better. Yeah, thank you so much, Todd and Henry, both of you, for making the time for this and for staying in tune and trying to raise so many of these important issues on your show.
Oh, you're very welcome, Chris. Hope to see you soon.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Henry. Very good. We got about 8 minutes left in the show. You know, Chris, glad he brought up the term Turtle Island and was talking about indigenous management of our wildlands before European settlement. I had the distinct pleasure of moving a turtle off of a back road. I'm not sure, but it could have been a box turtle. And there is a letter to the editor in today's White River Valley Herald from a guy who writes pretty regularly here, Neil Husher of Randolph, talking about last week's outside story, which was about the eastern box turtle. He wants to make a correction. Neil saw an eastern box turtle in the road just down from the Eshqua Bog Natural Area in Woodstock 9 years ago, and he published it at the iNaturalist website, took a picture of it. There are, however, no other postings for the turtle on the site in the state, and it's a long way to any other sightings in states nearby. Hopefully there were more than just one turtle in the area that they carry there still. He urges people, do not collect, he says wild box turtles, but I would say do not collect any turtle, as they are rare in the state and the Northeast in general. They have very small home ranges. I know the wood turtle is endangered here in Vermont. If found, please do not move them from their location, except to move them in the direction that they were traveling if they're on the road. And particularly if you live on a busy road, turtles are kind of slow and the next driver may not see them. So just a little bit of turtle advice. Some new books have just come out, one by Michael Grunewald, who writes for the New York Times and has written some other best-selling books. I've been reading a couple reviews. I'm looking at one here of the Kirkus Review. The name of the book is We Are Eating the Earth, and the subject is The Race to Fix Our Food System and Save Our Climate, an accessible and alarming look at the planet's land crisis. I've read a few blurbs about it. I'm not sure I'm going to get a copy of this book, but just to make you aware of it, it is also reviewed in a recent issue of The New Yorker, and I would highly recommend this because well-known environmental writer Elizabeth Colbert, K-O-L-B-E-R-T, this is the June 30th issue of The New Yorker, has a fascinating article called Seeds of Doubt: Can Agricultural Innovation Outpace Our Growing Appetites? And she has definitely a lot of interesting factoids in here about beef consumption, about using agricultural land to produce biofuels, etc. She basically reviews two books, both the Grunewald book and then a book about, where can I find the other guy here that she writes about? It's another professor, Václav Smil, who is a professor at the University of Winnipeg, and he has written a book about how to feed the world. So we have a lot of farms still left here in Vermont, small farms. There's some comments made about the organic food industry, but a couple of books out there about agriculture and trying to keep enough food to feed the growing population. Maybe we can work on slowing the growth of that population. Henry, what do you think?
Good luck.
Good luck.
we're slowing it right now. The U.S. is below birth rate for keeping a sustainable population, and Vermont is certainly like that too. We have an aging population, which is messing with the fact that we don't have enough people making money and paying taxes to support the state. So, worldwide, the population is expanding. All of this energy stuff, and the last thing we heard on EcoShock was about the death rate from people living in the rising heat.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, it will start to really tilt the whole population around the world just by killing people off.
Yeah.
But what happens when there's difficulty, and the World Bank has seen this, when there is environmental difficulty and survivability becomes an issue, is people tend to have larger families in order to have more support structure to try to see them through the hard times. So it's a thing that may boomerang even with climate change making more and more of the Earth uninhabitable.
Yeah.
I hate to be downer on that, but this is a really serious problem, and people are not taking it seriously. It needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah, it does. Hey, I also want to recommend in today's Herald, Larry Sackwis, representative from Randolph, has written about a couple of things that he's involved with, some bills involving protection of some endangered species here in Vermont. Act 47, let's see, was that signed? No, they've been combined into a single bill, and it's going to be discussed by the Fish and Wildlife Department on the second year of the biennium. Also a bill about anticoagulant rodenticides, which we know often end up poisoning and killing wildlife. And there is a bill to restrict the sale of that. That's House Bill 326. And I'm going to go to a good news story for my last little blurb here, Henry. You know that I like to ride the train even when I get turned around when I was 80% of the way to my destination the last time I was on a train. But I'm going to give them another try. So a new train has started between Minneapolis and Chicago. It's called the Borealis, and it got going in 2024. And they had some projections of what they thought the ridership would be, and it was a 15% higher than what they projected the record would be. A lot of people are using this train. It makes connections in a lot of places between those two places, and you can ride from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and probably faster than driving and certainly cheaper than a plane. And I think I saw a ticket, a one-way ticket for about $70. $70 to get from Minneapolis to Chicago, both downtown areas. They've changed the time of the train. The Empire Builder also services those cities, but it leaves Minnesota at 5 in the morning. What they're finding is a lot of college students and people that are on vacation that have a little bit of flexibility on when they leave and when they come back are using the Borealis. They had some corrosion in some of the wheels that slowed them down, but they got those corrected. And good to see that Amtrak, which is certainly not high on the priority list of our current federal government, as more cuts are projected, that there's one train that's doing pretty well. So if you get a chance, get on board the Borealis. We're running out of time, Henry. You get the final word.
Yeah, I just say trains in Europe are something we should copy.
Okay, great. We'll acknowledge our underwriters when we come next week. See you. Have a good week. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!